Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. We've got a poetry episode today. It's exciting. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. I'll kick it over to Will.
Yeah, Will Gadsby-Pete here, the chief strategy officer and other co-founder of Literal Humans. Genuinely very excited for this one. ChatGPT is going to feature heavily. We've all seen a lot of that in our news feeds ad nauseum over the last 6 months.
Yes, yes. Today's a good day for the pod. We just discovered a new cafe that apparently sits right behind our studio that has happy hour at 5 o'clock. So we'll be over there later today celebrating. And yeah, it's a good day. Getting on with it, we have a fantastic guest for our first podcast of the day. We're joined by Kieran Rennie, who's the English National Opera's creative in residence and is also a creative consultant and performance poet. Welcome to the pod, Kieran.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invite.
You're in studio with us. Where were you coming from today before you came?
Just coming from my workspace. I was doing a bit of working and a bit of deep dive in a few trends I was looking at.
Very cool. Very cool. Sounds like you did a lot of prep for this.
Probably a little bit. Yeah.
Probably more than we need. We're very casual, as you can tell. So. Thank you for joining us in studio. As always, we do with Tech Can't Save Us, we'll jump right into the headlines. One of the first pieces we shared with you was we've been talking a lot in the prep here about AI. And the first piece asked a provocative question about, like, can AI write authentic poetry? So just curious, what have you seen so far with, like, ChatGPT and all this stuff? Like, what do you think are the actual possibilities of AI getting into the poetry game?
I'm not necessarily worried as of yet, should I say. Technology does evolve quite quickly. At the moment, I see AI in this space as something which we can provide it with many wonderful ingredients, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to create a good dish or, in this sense, a great poem, because it requires human intervention, because I believe that what it lacks is, like, human experience to pick up the nuances. And yeah, I don't think it's necessarily as creative yet to where I'll be worried, but it's in an interesting space at the moment.
Yeah, I think whenever we talk about AI at the moment, we're always like, right now I'm not worried about it, but in 2 years I definitely am going to be. That piece in particular, what was interesting about it was it, like, looked at a couple of forms of, like, really, like, you know, more it like unique poetry creation, like one of which involved basically a collective of different poets finding little bits of writing and then kind of bringing them all together into one poem. And that's like a standard form that a lot of poets do.
Yeah.
And it talks about how is that different to what ChatGPT does, like, obviously relatively provocatively. And it's like, yeah, for sure, like, for some of that more kind of maybe some more niche poetry like that, maybe it could replicate a job to a degree that you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But I do still think that the thing that ChatGPT and all the other OpenAI software miss is at the moment is that kind of creative soul, it just doesn't have it. And even when you see very good examples of it put forward to on your LinkedIn feed or whatever, you read it and you're like, yeah, this is a mediocre copywriter. Don't get me wrong, it's very impressive. You've given me the results of a mediocre copywriter with very little prompt.
Of course.
But this is someone I would probably hire to train up into a storyteller rather than, like, holy shit, like, this is Shakespeare, like.
Yeah, I'd agree, because I believe, obviously, it's like, as they say, garbage in, garbage out sort of thing, if we're going to get really technical in the terms of techie speak. But as you said, it lacks the creative flair and the creative soul, I would say, which I don't think it necessarily can be mimicked as of yet. Maybe in 10 to 15 years we'll be in a different space, but at the moment I think it's really interesting, because it could use it in a sense for ideation phase, where it could give you, from given a prompt, it could give you an idea, but I don't think it will come with a fully fledged poem. I highly doubt it.
The thing that was fascinating to me is, like, the mirror-like nature of AI. Like you said, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, we're seeing that in terms of bias, you know,
and
getting into that. But, like, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit concerning in a way too, because it's like, well eventually we'll get to the point where we're putting in enough good stuff that maybe it can put out, you know.
Yes.
So like if garbage in, garbage out is true, we're putting in garbage now, we're getting garbage back, but like, what actually happens when we put in quality?
I was gonna say one of the questions I had for both of you is, when AI does get to the point where it creates poetry that's as beautiful as anything that could be written, what then? Like, you know, not in terms of, like, let's be fearful for our jobs, but, like, you know, it's a very interesting question. It kind of goes to the death of the author. author, like in the theory that you should enjoy work just on its own merits without knowing anything of the author, where, but like in the counter school of which is, well, no, like it, like if this person is writing about their pain and their like sorrow, for me to know they've actually had that lived experience in their life enriches my reading of their poetry. And on the flip side, if I were to read this beautiful poem that like deeply moved me, and then at the end of it I found out that it was written by an AI, I do think I'd lose something there. Like it would feel, I'd feel scammed.
I guess I think about it too though in terms, like I don't, we talked about this with our designers because now there's, you know, all this new technology where you can, you know, put in prompts and you know, design comes out, right?
Yep, yeah, I've
like,
seen that.
But I guess I don't feel like any less intrigued or interested in or impressed by designs that come from my designers because they used Adobe or because they used Figma or something like that. Like to me, it's still brilliant. Mine doesn't work that way. I'm more of a writer, you know, potentially like yourself. So I'm wondering if it will get to that point with AI where it's sort of just, it's just a tool, right? And like there's still going to be authors and poets creating amazing stuff because of their lived experience. But there will also be folks using these tools, and these tools maybe independently, maybe more scary, creating this stuff as well. I mean, I don't know.
I'm in this phase where my company's scaling. I'm building many bridges with words. Yeah. I've reached a stage where I'm at that tipping point, like, do I get a VA? And I'm like, the amount I know about tech, can I automate some of the process, like the billing or maybe chasing an invoice or the process and making sure like all my projects are running on time and there's no bottlenecks and that sort of thing. I can literally automate it using this, literally monday.com, Zapier and other integrations with my accounting software and that sort of thing. So now we're in a tricky stage of what will be the evolution, because we focus a lot on the tech, but jobs, what will happen in the space of VAs and PAs? Because at the moment, they're all doing any really taxing tasks if I took someone on. It's literally diary management and project management, which I'm literally pivoting into a new space, and it's seem to be working efficiently at the moment.
That's the stuff that on the, like away from kind of like the sort of poetry and like specific examples that does scare me is like, people have always got scared about every new tech revolution with replacing jobs. Like people thought the steam engine would destroy society, and actually it just meant that everyone went from agricultural lives to city lives and you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think the scary thing about AI and what we're seeing is it doesn't seem like there are jobs that replace the jobs it takes. Like, you know, it's not like the normal revolution where people go from working in a farm to working in a city.
Yeah.
They go from working to not working, and then there's no new job unless you're an expert in deep learning and AI.
Yeah.
That said, I did see today, for the first time on LinkedIn, someone had a job title of ChatGPT translator and interpreter. And I was just like, and they actually work for another agency. It was super interesting, which we should probably talk about. But like, I was just, I looked at the guy's profile and I was just like, this is super interesting. Like, I think there is a little bit of hope that like new jobs will crop up because we're going to have people just like designers who know how to use Figma and Adobe and stuff like that, who know how to use and leverage these tools. I think in the aggregate, yes, there'll be fewer jobs. And, you know, to sort of our previous guest, Rohit Talwar's point, like, you know, we're looking at a revolution in work. But yeah, I don't know. I think I'm optimistic that there'll still be like new avenues and new markets created. I don't know.
I get you. But I think that's an interesting outlook, because it could be two truths could be right, because it could be that, and it could be a scenario where those, even those new jobs have a short life cycle and everyone gets familiar with it. Totally. When we create an Apple which simplifies many complex processes within that, will we still need those engineers or GPT consultants? That's where I'm wondering how much longevity we have in that sort of space.
It is interesting, and like you do also wonder, like we probably could get rid of jobs today if we, in a year's time, if we really tried with the technology available to you, so you could probably automate most of life. Like in, like if every developed country in the world got together and went, let's fucking get rid of jobs. We spoke to Rohit Talwar about a few things, and in the sort of prep for it, he spoke about like, you could very easily build a skyscraper that you turn into a farm and basically automated all of the water and solar panels and fooding and create a self-sustaining giant farm that could feed a city. And you could do that tomorrow if people actually got together and cared about it. But the capitalist system that we live in is so built against that, that it fundamentally needs consumers and buyers as well as jobs, that like the technology will never be able to make a dent in that. To both your points, like ChatGPT comes around, it just becomes another tool that people use because they, no one wants to get rid of jobs, because then you have to rethink society. And I just don't think anyone's up for that project.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
We touched on ChatGPT a little bit, and it's specifically for marketers, like a bit of a game changer, at least, you know, especially for our writers. writers. And
of course.
But the second piece we shared with you talked about it not really quite being able to replace humans anytime soon. But curious, like you mentioned automation in your work and things like that. Yeah. Are you seeing applications for things like ChatGPT in terms of like your creative consulting work or just taking a bit of...
I wouldn't necessarily use it because it goes against my business and like principles in terms of doing tasks which I would be paid or like working with a client in that sense, because they pay for my creative flair, my injecting my poetic flair mm-hmm. into various outputs. Mm-hmm. However, some people could use it for B2Bs, for mm-hmm. example, as we were saying, like content creation or product descriptions. Mm-hmm. I've played around with it, and it's, from what I've seen on YouTube, the bog standard one is it's half okay. So mm-hmm. it depends on your budget and stuff. If someone has just had a new startup and mm-hmm. they're selling on like doing drop shipping and stuff like that, I think it could do a fairly decent job mm-hmm. with obviously human intervention for someone who may not be a great writer mm-hmm. or it could help those that are actually neurodiverse or may struggle maybe from someone that speaks a different language and it's mm-hmm. a second language could give them a better steer within reason. However, it's not something I would personally use per se. But I've seen interesting things online to your point. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily in the marketing space, but there's been a great deal of concern with teachers, especially in universities, in terms of like handing in essays. Because obviously you've got Tune-It, I believe. Those that don't know, when you hand in an essay, it goes through a system and it sees whether you've correctly cited or it borders plagiarism. Because obviously every essay, you have to be well informed. So you do borrow learnings and arguments from other people and interject your own opinion and take. So that's where I think this technology can be problematic, I would say. Mm. Because I don't believe all of them are easily picked up on, which it could be hiring people that are not capable of doing a particular job, which is quite worrying.
Yeah, I saw literally on my newsfeed today that some kid had handed an essay that he'd written entirely in ChatGPT and it had got like a 2-1, which, yeah.
What's is, that? Sorry.
It's like it's like a B+.
Oh.
For any of our American listeners. The second best mark you can get at university. So yeah, it is scary. And I think it's... A lot of technologies are being developed in tandem at the moment that like really gets to the core of what is reality. There is now almost an inherent value on truth and reality that wasn't there before. You know, like you kind of saw it with Fox News of the world, just taking reality and going, this is optional. Let me create something else. And you used to need to be able to do that. You used to have like a giant, you know, propaganda arm to put forward your view. Whereas now, you know, you need a software and an understanding of how to use it. And you can pretend that you are a very good writer. So yeah, I do think as much as the uses of ChatGPT and tools like it right now are the story, I do almost think like the response to that and how society sort of like now deals with the fact that most, maybe not right now, but in 2 years' time, probably someone with a smartphone can pretend to be most things. That's going to be a huge... Hey, maybe this is the point of conversation we're just having. Maybe that's the jobs that get created. Essentially professional bullshit protectors that catch that sort of thing.
I kind of agree. And the one thing I'm concerned about with the increase of AI technology is the biases in which it has. Mm-hmm. So to take away slightly, fear to the left, I've been to exhibitions where they had AI facial recognition software, which doesn't recognize people that are black.
Yeah.
And I've seen today, I believe... ChatGPT offended the Hindu community, so like groups that are always widely represented or within the rooms of those that are coding and inputting all this information, the testers, we've got a great moral and ethical responsibility to ensure that those that are creating this new technology represent all those who they're hoping to help or support or that's my biggest gripe with new technologies and lack of diversity, and that's even jobs, lifestyles, everything in a holistic sense.
Garbage in, garbage out,
literally. Because I've read loads I'm a big reader. I do a lot of trend work, which people are not always aware. I believe people was playing around with ChatGPT, should I say, and I think if he puts anything to do with Trump, it wouldn't allow, but if you did the other parties, it would allow. So even biases like that. So then we're reaching a stage where we're going to have greater echo chambers where we're only getting limited views, whether you side left or right wing, whatever. I believe you should have an option to necessarily view and speak openly.
Mm-hmm. What happened at the exhibition you mentioned? Like, was it just a facial recognition, like, to enter or something like that?
There was a poem. I don't know if you went to the exhibition at the Barbican. It was there's a poem, but her name was Joy. I can't recall her second name, sadly. Mm. But she has a PhD and she works in that sort of space. Mm. And she wrote a poem talking about how, because she works in a space, how it couldn't recognize her face.
Wow.
Because obviously the people that are testing and creating this software were largely white.
Mm.
So then obviously the computer's only getting that sort of data set. And I've seen it before with like automated hand wash and dryers. It's just something that you, it's not, I would say, necessarily intentional. Yeah. Just, again, lack of diversity in any field is problematic. As I said in one of my poems, it leaves too many blind spots.
I do have a problem with those automated hand. Like, I was like, I never even thought it would be connected to my skin tone. I was like, fuck, this thing doesn't work well. You know,
yeah,
I mean, never thought.
Yeah, because if I do it with my palms up, it sounds crazy, but it's just, it often works better. But if I do it, it may or may not.
Those examples are kind of like, well, this is a bit annoying, but like, you know, there have been a ton of scandals in the finance sector where they've used automated algorithms that hugely make even work, like, don't get me wrong, it's garbage in, garbage out, so all the software does is expose what was already in the system.
Of course.
But it made, it just almost basically any black family that applied for a loan just automatically got rejected. That sort of thing, it can be way more impactful when you don't fucking do your proper homework before you create the algorithm.
Yes.
You know, like the idea that some entrepreneur doesn't get the money they need just because of the color of their skin because their AI was designed by white men is just fucking insane. Like, it's so infuriating.
Yeah.
I think it's already definitely happening. Like, I've heard tell of VCs using, you know, AI for, like, initial qualification.
Yeah.
You know, someone applies.
For a job. And
yeah. Well, for funding.
Funding. Yeah. See,
but also for jobs, too. Yeah. I mean, like, so, like, let's run you through this, you know, sort of algorithm that we've created, unfortunately, with our biases. And, like, you're not even going to get a chance to have an interview or to pitch properly because we've, you know, the AI's looked at your pitch deck and seen that you're black or a person of color and kind of, you know, really unfortunate. There was a whole thing during COVID with the pulse oximeters and, like, them not being able to adequately understand the blood oxygen levels of black folks. And it's like, those people weren't treated properly. Some of those folks died, you know what I mean? Like, because they weren't treated properly because they didn't understand, you know, what their blood oxygen levels were. And it's just like, come on, you know? So I don't know. It's
To kind of bring it full circle back to poetry and sort of art, one of the many things that scares me about sort of AI is like, do you just get to a point, it's like, yeah, this algorithm can create the most beautiful poem, but it can never change genres. Like you'd never go from classic dad rock and then had hip hop like come about. All you'd have do is get better and better classic dad rock if AI was around and just taking that as the sample set. And like, do you get to a point where culture kind of just stops and plateaus?
Where I would see potential space, it would be create a new school of poetry. How I see it, it's like, as you was talking about, what he's referring to before is found poetry. That's things I've played around, it's quite fun. I would see it as more a new school of poetry rather than say, oh, this is poetry, because poetry is so like wide ranging. I could see it as a school of poetry, but it's not one I'm particularly a fan of per se at the moment.
Well, good opportunity to dig into specifically what you're doing. You mentioned building bridges with words, and that's your organization, would you call
it?
Would be curious to hear like what your inspiration was for founding it, for starting it, and what your ultimate goal is with building bridges with words.
Oh, of course. So building bridges with words, that came out of me just being like, I was thinking they called it polymath. I'm obsessed with so many different things. So I'm a marketer. I worked in advertising agency for a couple of years and worked in arts organisations as well, supporting their teams. I've got like a marketing and business strategy hat. I'm also, call myself a performance poet. So I perform poetry, and performance aspect is something I really hone. If anyone has seen me perform will kind of testify to that sort of aspect. Classify myself as a creative consultant because I don't believe all my work necessarily needs me to necessarily write a poem. It can come out of conversations where I might have helped pivot a business idea or business strategy. My work kind of transcends. So to market it and simplify what I do, I build bridges of words. So it could lead to me like writing a manifesto. So it could be me writing a hypothetically, say, a company wanting to appeal to a young demographic and they had a business strategy and it's a bit hard for new people to join the company to understand. I'd write a manifesto that rings true to their brand strategy, their goals and vision in a kind of poetic form. So that's what my manifestos kind of lead to.
I absolutely no problem if the answer to this question is no, but could you drop a little poetry for our listeners? Would that be of interest to you?
People must do this all the time to you. Spring it on you.
Yeah, I'm trying to think which one I should do.
I feel like it's like comedians. It's like, tell a joke right now.
I just
if you give me a moment, I'll
take your time.
I'll pull up one.
It's our first poem.
This is our first ever poem on TechCon Savers.
Intentional poem. Yeah. I feel like maybe we've...
So this one is called A Medley, Poetry Chose Me. I chose poetry, no, it chose me. When say nothing was my given speak, you read between the lines, found a metaphor in me. I am snow leopard, not sheep, habitat concrete. Seen friends become icy freeze, chest tightens. But poetry teaches me how to breathe. Police sirens is my equivalent to silence. They think it's lines I'm reciting, not realizing they call them bully vans where I'm residing. Fist titans, poetry tweets, keep writing. I ain't seen them man for 4 summers and the gap keeps widening. In blue flashing lights, I testify, I don't cry, I just write. Poetry provides comfort during troubling times. I could have lost my uncle, still send shivers down my spine. I spoke. Did you listen? Did you listen that night? Cuts by the government cut deep. You can see the lacerations in my generation. 9 years on and we still need saving. I'm not here to tick boxes. I cannot pretend these boxes do not exist. I'm in many different spaces, somehow coexist. Maybe that's why you always see me building a bridge. Thank you.
Amazing. Wow.
ChatGPT will never be able to do that. That was fucking incredible, man.
I'm convinced.
Thank you. So as you can see, it picks up on like my life experiences. So like ChatGPT, I'm not really worried about because this is like my lived experience of me pivoting different times of my life.
You know, like we said as well, like if I'd heard that and then someone told me ChatGPT wrote it, I'd be like, well, that means like it's lost all, you know, like the reason that resonates and you love it is because it's coming from a human.
It's funny because the police sirens are my equivalents of silence, that line, like just really, and I was in the gym earlier listening to Blue Lights by Georgia Smith. And I remember like chatting with a lot of friends, you know, who happen to be, you know, friends of color, black folks, and we were at a festival and they were kind of like, we're looking around and you know, my friend turned to me and was just like, the other folks here who aren't from these communities and don't have this experience with police will never understand this song. And you know, there's shades of gray, ironically, to that. But like, and we just sort of looked around and we saw people just like bump into it. And like, we were having a reaction to that song and our experiences and all the things that were going on at the time in just a different way, you know, and kind of like, again, AI could never replace that. And you're speaking to that in your poem and just kind of reminded me of that moment of like, wow, like this is the depth of human experience and like understanding and sentiment and things like that. So thank you for sharing that with
us. Thank you.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was amazing. Probably my favorite bit of our podcasting history so far.
Yeah.
No problem at all.
The next question is, what success stories can you share from your work so far? That was kind of one already. But,
thank you.
Yeah, how's it going?
It's going tremendously well. I can't play. I'm so blessed. I've done a range of different projects. My ethos is I build bridges. So it's both home and away, and so bridges near and far. So the last 2 to 3 years I've pivoted and tried to do more within my community. So I'm from Tottenham, Borough Haringey. Recently, over the last couple of years, I've worked closely with them. I was commissioned a couple of years ago to create a piece of work exploring what it means to be Black British. I produced a collaborative poem with the young people, so it was people from St. Thomas More and Haringey Chicken Shed. We created a poem during the lockdown, which was interesting. So I was heavily reliant on my iPad Pro. That's part of my stack. But that project produced a lyric poem, which you can see on the Haringey website. And that was a really proud moment. So that was called Black Quill. Outside of that, I've also did a workshop similarly a couple of years ago as well. And it was a really interesting one because it got to where I got to apply some psychology that I know. So I built a team. So it was me, a fellow poet who I was mentoring, and a playwright. And we collectively created a program in which we was working with a school outside of London. So they tasked me with looking at language and unconscious bias and creating an inclusive environment where we're conscious of the words we use. We looked at media representation. We did a deep dive on what unconscious bias is and the different forms of unconscious bias. And just thinking about how we talk to people, even something could be like a loaded question, like I could say to you, where are you from?
Yeah.
Mm. Depending on your lived experience, that could be quite triggering, if I can't think of a better word. Because where you're from, someone says, where you're from, it's a problematic, can be seen a problematic question for me, because I'll say, okay, I'm born here. The next question that normally precedes is, okay, where are your parents from? And then the next piece, they were born here. The next question is, oh, so where's your family from? I'm like, okay, my family's from Jamaica. My grandparents are from Jamaica. Where someone asks, what's your heritage? We could get to the point and I'll be like, okay, I'm from Jamaican heritage. So it's little things like that, which some of the work I'm keen to do more of, because it's really rewarding. And there was loads of young people there. There was off the timetable for 3 days. So it's really unique opportunity. And yeah, I saw them grow so much over that time. I saw them with a great sense of allyship. So that's like work I'm really proud of, which I don't always necessarily go on my landing page or my website and stuff, but I think that really means a lot. And hopefully that will spark creative interest in the next generation. So that's part of my work. Outside of that, I'm the current creative in residence at the ENO, which is an amazing opportunity.
And what's ENO stand for our guests?
Okay, so I've done the acronym thing, which I always tell people off when I'm in meetings. So it's the English National Opera.
Amazing. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and it's an exciting opportunity. As far as I know, I'm the first poet to have been like a resident poet that I know of. I could be wrong. I might have to do more reading.
Sure.
So I'm there for the entire season. I've spoken to 2 operas already. So that's Tosca. Amazing. That's that we had a run, and it's a wonderful life. Mm. And we're working on a few more productions.
Tell us more, like, what is your role with the actual opera performance?
Oh, so I will sit in and rehearsals and see how I'm creatively inspired. Wow. Some will take the form of poetry. Mm. There may be other forms as well. I might expand on doing poetry. What I did for It's a Wonderful Life is where one of the questions or prompts I gave to people is, what is a wonderful life? Mm. If you think about our memories and stuff, we always normally focus on the bad things, but we forget about, like, you guys wonderfully bought me a coffee. Like, that is something we all overlook. Mm. And say we had a bad day. Mm-hmm. Say I was running like 10 minutes late. Mm. I'll be like, oh, I had a bad day, I was late. Well, mm-hmm. you guys brought me a coffee. People held the door for me. Mm-hmm. People said hello. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things I got people to, like, look back on, like, their childhood memories and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We had like a Christmas tree and asking what is a wonderful moment, where I gave a bit more prompts and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm just showing the breadth of my work. That's why I'm kind of called like a creative in residence, because I might take things a little bit further than just a poetry performance, depending on the task and how I'm inspired. But I'm really thankful. I'm learning about the world of opera, from all fairness, until this residency. I didn't know a lot.
How did your residency at the English National Opera land for the folks back in Tottenham? How was it received?
Initially, you go, oh, rah, opera. And I'm like, so I'm like, yeah, it's cool. Come. I'll be like, this is what I'm going to, like, obviously, everyone knows about Code Switch. I'll be like, yeah, come true. Like, I'll bring you through. And then, like, come chill with me and see tell me if you like it. If you don't like it, it's cool.
Has,
like,
it happened? Have they come through?
Yeah, I thought some of my friends have come through, and they like, one of them is like, Gary, let me know what comes. I'm like, all right, cool, no worries. Let's do it.
You got them on the calendar on the English National Opera site.
I'll be like, okay, cool. In the group chat, the GC, I'm like, oh, guys, like,
that's sick.
I don't know, cool. They'll come through. And the reason why I'm thankful for the opportunity and why I took it on is it fulfills my ethos of building bridges with words, because people have perceptions. I myself, I'm honest, I have perceptions that opera was necessarily accessible. Mm. So I thought you had to, like, dress up. The ENO is, like, got relaxed.
It's chill.
It's chill. Like, I could go in my jeans, could go in formal wear if I felt like dressing formal and dressing up for opening night, and anything in between. I've taken lines from my poem. Sorry, I'm talking rhymes. Sorry, that's my poem, Fine Melody. That I
talk in rhymes. You're allowed to say that. Yeah. Poet.
it's been a great experience, and I'm just learning about how layered opera is. Mm. So obviously I knew about the score, and but I didn't really take account the sense of, like, choreography. I'll see them as like athletes, a sense, because they're physically fit and they're still holding phenomenal notes and have great range. And there's even some productions going to come in soon that incorporates juggling. That's Akhenaten and Philip Glass.
Wow.
And there's dance, there's so many. They've got the set, you've got the lighting, they've got the costume. So you can imagine it's just like it's a lovely playground to be in to be inspired creatively.
How did it come about? Like, did they approach you?
They approached me. This came off the back of, I did some work. I did loads of work during lockdown. So it was a lockdown aria, so they did send out challenge for those young people under 25 to respond about the experience during the lockdown. And I was using their words, their pictures, their arias, which is like similar to poetry, but not quite, to create poem kind of capsulating the experience for a lot of young people. And that took off and did really well. It was well received within the company and those that are fans of the English National Opera. Yeah, it went from being on hosting the Google exhibition, which they were commissioned to do, to going being broadcast at Ali Pali or Alexandra Palace. Yeah. So they was doing like a drive-in, because everyone obviously pivoted. So I was doing drive-through opera. Which
like in the parking lot there.
Yeah, it was groundbreaking. And they kind of showcase the poem that I wrote, inspired, building the witch tapestry of the young people. And it ended up on the BBC when they were showing some of the work the BBC was doing, which was great. So off the back of that, because some people often think poetry necessarily has to stay in one particular sector, and that's my ethos, is to continue to build these bridges and challenge the perceptions of poetry and words and art in a holistic sense. I've done poetry in art venues. I was commissioned a number of years ago in conjunction with Apples and Snakes, where I was performing in the Queen's Gallery in Buckingham Palace. I was responding to paintings as well. Been in the Tate Britain. It's a whole host of different places, and I also do bespoke poems for corporate clients as well. So I've been all different spaces. I've entered the energy sector. So I've worked quite closely with Energy UK. So they're a humongous like board or company that works with all like E.ON and all that sort of thing.
You're like a muse for different. I mean, like no, but honestly, like all the different applications of poetry in all those different settings is fascinating. You know, I mean, at least to the layperson who's not sort of engaged. But, yeah, that's really interesting.
I was just going to say, like, the English National Opera in particular, it's like such a cool thing that they have. Like, it feels like something out of like a old medieval, here is the court poet, like come out and just do poetry because we love poetry. Like, it's a really cool thing to
they're really forward thinking. They're a brilliant company, really forward thinking. I love the work they do.
That's great.
It's been quite groundbreaking. It's being there and seeing a passionate team and everyone is it's phenomenal.
Maybe we need a poet in residence or creative in residence at the agency.
Fuck yeah. So on board with that.
Just chat. to that point around, you know, the different applications of poetry and we sort of have this, we talked a little bit about AI influencing writing and poetry and things like that, but curious to hear about how you've seen technology in general, AI can be a part of that, influence the work of poets like yourself, and in particular, like, interested in your take on, like, insta-poets. I know that was a whole phenomenon. Okay. And also, is there poetry talk? Is that a thing?
What do you mean, poetry talk? What do you mean?
On TikTok? Is there poetry TikTok?
Yeah, that's something. That's a space I'm exploring. I'm inquisitive, so I'm in all different spaces. Insta-poetry, I see that is just another stage. Similar to TikTok, there's different stages. Insta-poetry could be cool for those that could be starting out. Maybe that's they feel more comfortable performing on social media. Some people are what I'd refer to as page or digital page poet, should we say, if it's Instagram. And they might feel happy to display their work on there, which is fine. And similar thing to TikTok. I do use like Instagram as my digital sketchbook here and there, but I'm more in the get Karen in the room, get Karen on the stage. I'm more that sort of person.
Sure.
That's one of the gripes I have sometimes as being a creative, that we always feel we have to have a humongous social media presence.
Right.
I think it's unhealthy for our mental health, in terms of it's always being readily available. I get loads of notifications. My phone literally lives on Do Not Disturb just to make things manageable. And I check in from time to time. And I post when I want to share, but I don't feel obligated to share everything.
Right.
Like some of the things I've spoken about are not on the internet, and I'm fine with that.
Totally. Good for you, because I feel like that's really hard for, you know, folks, like just creatives in general.
Yeah.
And folks who are, like, part of their work is to build a following, or at least they feel it is, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, like, it feels like they need to do it for, you know, to make money, frankly, and it's challenging.
You do. It's a bit of both. So I promote some of the work, but it's like, just have a chat. I'm quite laid back as we're having that. This feels chill. Just have a chat.
Yeah.
Just drop me an email. Even if you look at my tone of voice on my website, it's quite chill. It's like, I'm holding an email away, and it's literally that. Just drop me an email.
You've got a cool job. I mean, that's, many cool jobs, I should say.
You have worked on an insane variety of projects, but that is the one common thread throughout them. Like, it's
words and people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, you know, a testament to how good you are at what you do, that you managed to so succinctly summarize the through line through everything you do with your branding. So yeah, very, very, as two salty, dyed-in-the-wool marketers. We really, really respect it.
Thank you.
That's what it says on the tin, as you say here.
We covered so many of the great projects you're on, so we'll probably skip that. But yeah, I mean, you kind of touched on there at the end, like just some of the frustrations and challenges within your industry. Like what do you find are kind of like, the biggest friction points of what you do and the folk you work with?
Yeah, it's literally, I think in terms of mental health, I think it's that being readily available at all times. Mm. I think that's unhealthy. Mm. And that's across the creative industry. I talked about poetry, I've dabbled in drama, performed and acted here and there. Even with that, everyone just feels they have to always be ready, available, always on the...
These are your clients, you feel like?
Not necessarily my clients, mm-hmm. I've created a good rapport with them where we've got, like, I make sure I'm ahead of schedule and I have check-ins and stuff, and that's fine. But I'm just talking about, I've seen in other, when wearing different hats, working for different places where... I'm sure you guys worked in agencies and stuff where it's like you're on demand at all times, which is, I believe, is unhealthy.
It's too much.
we work in one now where we're on demand at all times.
Yeah, it's unhealthy, and I don't believe it's always good. I don't think you always produce your best work when you're under those pressures because you just got like, yeah. I think that would be one of my gripes. And two, sometimes I think lack of transparency sometimes with pricing and stuff. I think some people that haven't got a good network or are not confident enough might get not paid as well as they should be.
Any tips on, like, we find pricing to be at least one of the most fascinating aspects of our work. Like, we're constantly just every as leaders of the firm, we're always talking about pricing. How do we price this? How do we think about this? How do we value the team's time? How do we, any tidbits on pricing that you've uncovered that you'd like to share with our audience? Any pointers?
I think there's a book I read about negotiation. I can't remember. I'd have to drop you a note where you could add it to the thing. I just believe you should just demand what you believe your value is, and if the person says no, then you haven't lost any business really, because money wasn't actually in your account.
I feel like the negotiating isn't the problem. I feel like it's calculating it.
That's a tricky one.
That's the bit I struggle with. Much am I worth?
It's a two-point question.
Yeah. No, but not in like a self-belief way, but just like in a like. Okay, fuck. What's an actually fair price? Like, what's a price that I would walk away from this thinking I'm happy with that, and I also feel like the client is walking away happy with it, and like that's the bit we struggle on, is like trying to escape that. Like, all right, let's try and get as much money as possible, and get into the like, okay, what's the fair price, and how do we get ourselves there?
Money is just one marker of value.
Yeah,
that's one other thing I have to kind of say before any clients become money hungry. But it's. Because I've received value from an experience which has led on to more work in different sectors and stuff. So price is not necessarily the main driver of my business, but it's an important one for expansion and sustainability. Mm-hmm. Another thing could be like, what am I going to learn? we forget that.
It is an odd thing to price yourself. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's
challenging.
It's an unnatural thing.
Especially now, because our industry is, but like you said, it's unnatural, but that is our industry. Yeah. It's like... So yeah, it's not normal to be like that, but
they're hiring your brain on it. They're hiring your brain, and they want to see what can your brain produce, just like ChatGPT, weirdly, in what space of time.
What about you guys? What have you seen as like pressure points in terms of the industry?
I think we've certainly found. I don't know if this has been your experiences. You have to make the mistakes and get burnt, and then you learn not to do it. We've fallen into almost all of the sort of early founders, perhaps at some point, from being so desperate for work that you undersell yourself, to getting a client in at a good price point, but they're a total nightmare, and then keeping them for longer than you should have, and then it affects team morale.
Yeah.
And I think we've learned our lessons and from getting burnt a little, and then just going, like, me and Paul will be on a call and I'll just message him in like Slack, like, this feels like another insert client, and he's like, yeah, totally, let's definitely not touch this.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to stuff we've gotten into, is like, what does our onboarding process look like? What is our is our sort of scoping process look like with that client initially, so that we can uncover those things? I think a big part of it too is like information asymmetry, because clients are arguably hiring you because you know and can do things that they themselves,
of course,
either can't do or have chosen not to do.
Yeah.
And I think one thing you need to check in with yourself about when you're bringing on new clients is like, how much of that information asymmetry are you willing to overcome, like with and for your client? You know, because ultimately it's going to lead to instances. We just had a client the other day who's been with us for almost 2 years who just realized that like we helped them rank for keywords and they fought us like every, you know, like tooth and nail because they wanted the strategy to go this way. And we're like, no, it's got to go this way.
Yeah.
And now they're seeing the results and they're like, they're chuffed, you know, they love it, you know, and it's just like, well, Jesus, like I wish you kind of, you know, so like, how are you going to walk them through a process of education and onboarding, and ideally do it up front so that they're on board with the strategy, they understand where you're you know, taking them, going with them, and you can kind of walk that path a bit more fluidly together. I think that's kind of where we are in our journey. So,
and I think it's one, setting the tone of transparency. I think then that leads to a number of like micro questions, which is unhelpful for both parties because you're miscommunicating, which wastes time and it inadvertently affects the product or whatever you're or the service, whatever you're producing. If there's an issue, just say it and let's have a solution mindset and solve the issue.
Yeah.
Rather than like holding on to it and expecting the other party to know.
It's something we've certainly found. And then like, again, kind of the thing we burnt on and got better at identifying is like, there is a certain type of client that sees an agency or a freelancer as a whipping post. They would treat that agency in a way that if they ever treated one of their internal staff, HR will call them up and just be like, mate, you're out of a job. You can't be fucking talking to people like that.
Yes.
That's what we've kind of know. Like, don't be wrong, most thought has moved away from that, but there are still those people who either, and surprisingly, some of them still quite young themselves, but like they clearly have had some experience where that's how they think you treat a creative agency of any description.
Yes.
And identifying them and running the other direction has been probably one of our biggest learnings.
It's like, who hurt you?
Yeah.
Why are you trying to hurt me?
Genuinely, who hurt you?
No, I get it. I've seen a lot. Yeah.
Well, good moment to transition us into the lightning round, where we ask you a series of questions and, you know, quick, snappy answers if we can request. And these are just kind of like ways to get to know you a little bit better and for the audience to kind of understand you better as a person. You sort of answered this first one earlier and you shared with us a piece of tech that you use. But yeah, what's your tech stack look like and what's been a game-changing tech product for you?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I love this. So my iPad Pro, that has done wonders in me. Cool. So I was an early adopter of the M1. So that was like a beast when it came out. So I was like, yeah. And he was like,
what's the M1 for our audience? What's the M1?
M1 is the first Apple silicon chip. See, I'm sounding like a real nerd. So this is the side people haven't really heard of me. Like, I'm normally a like, yeah, cool.
He's also an early adopter of the M1. So this is my fucking jam. Yeah, tell me about your battery life.
I'm going to start talking about pixels per minute, bit per inch. Let me stop.
Next question. What's one problem that tech cannot solve for us?
It's one that's quite controversial. I think social anxiety. I would say that because you replace it with a crutch, I would say. So if you're someone that suffers from social anxiety, I'm an introvert myself, you wouldn't believe so, but I am. But I believe you have to kind of take little steps outside your comfort zone. So poetry, that's one of the reasons I entered poetry. I've always liked poetry. I studied in college. I did my A-levels. I was studying college and actually did a course, another like stuff with the same level as A-levels to be comfortable performing in front of people. But where I say tech can be limiting is that I'll get so used to tweeting someone or texting someone rather than having a face-to-face conversation. So where you're in a situation where you can't or talk to some different generation, it's not necessarily going to help. That's my take.
Yeah,
totally. And often makes it worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you
know, like
if you're on Instagram or LinkedIn, you think everyone's life is better than it is, and you feel really bad about yours. Like, why am I not making millions like this random person? Or why doesn't my holiday look that great? Like,
it's the highlight reel, essentially. Yeah, and I think it's unhealthy. So I've got a philosophy when I'm online. It's either I'm engaging, or I'm there to learn.
Yeah.
Not there to just scroll.
That's really good. That's really good guardrails for your
because
sometimes I'm just like, what am I doing? Like,
because I need to know about trends, what people are doing, but I don't feel the need to like. I didn't reach a stage where you lost so many people. It's hard to literally stay in contact with everyone.
And it goes, you know, you just blink and you're like, what the fuck have I spent 40 minutes doing? This couldn't be more of a waste of my time if I tried. I'd have got more out of just staring at a wall.
Yeah.
We spoke about before, and we bring her up a lot. We spoke to an awesome woman who created basically a non-shit version of Facebook for women called Communia. And we speak about this a lot. I just think there's such an open gap in the market now at the moment for a social media platform that isn't
awful. Like, it isn't aimed at selling you stuff. Like, just does what Facebook used to do, there which is connect one. You with your closest folks.
There
friend.
Is one.
Yeah, there's a few, but, yeah, nothing's quite caught fire.
No,
yet.
Be Real was okay, but then the notifications got on my nerves.
They're tanking now. They're tanking.
Yeah, I saw that, but yeah. I gathered because the notifications alone were quite intrusive. The way it's like, you have to,
and it's the feed. Like, that's what the problem. Like, it. Like, we've spoken about before. That was the turning point that fucked every social platform replicated was that endless scroll feed that you have that needs to be populated with content. Mm. And like, that was the point. You used to have to jump on your mate's profile to see what they were up to. Yes. So you only stayed in touch with the 20 people. Whereas now you're like, oh, there's a person that I went to university with like 10 years ago. Like, oh, they just had a kid. Cool. Like, it's literally that.
Cause I've been in the same scenario. Is like, my network's largely creatives and friends are from years back as well. And then like, I'm seeing them like, oh, I did this. And you're like, and look at my feed. I'm like, my feed only shows me maybe about 4%. I'm not even like a massive social media presence. And I'm like, this is what I mean. So then someone could have put something up. They might have thought you've ignored them. You just can't see it. Then you have to, on Instagram, which is awful. Now you have to like follow them or, I can't remember what button you have to press. You press a button to make sure you see them and make them a favorite. That's it. Right. Which is, it's awful.
Yep. You may have already answered our next lightning round question, which is our tech for bad question, but what's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
It's controversial again.
Yeah.
We love it.
I don't like Tesco club cards. I've got a big problem with them.
Oh, fuck.
Wow.
That was the first time we've ever had this.
I love this question.
Love it.
This is such my favorite.
The reason why, I've been looking at how the pricing is done. Okay, we exchange data for, if I'm talking quite openly, exchange data for a slight reduction. Well, okay. The days I haven't downloaded the app, which is probably bad for me.
Yeah.
But if I don't have my fob, I'm paying inflated prices because you don't have my data. That's how I look at it. I could be wrong, but I don't understand what is the benefit of me having a club card. And then the pricing, if you compare it to, I'm going to get real nerdy now, if you compare the pricing to the competitors, sometimes even that price is not really a discount.
Yeah.
So then what am I... Why do I have a club card?
It's funny you mention it because I'm not going to say where this is exactly, but I live above the notoriously worst Tesco in London. I'm not going to say where it is.
Cool.
But it's got a 1.6 rating on Google. And
it is a truly terrible Tesco.
Yeah, it's really bad. I've introduced myself to people in London like, oh yeah, I live above the shit at Tesco in London. They're like, oh yeah, right next to the... But, you know, you go in there and like the cold doors are open and like there's just a spill on the floor every time somehow. Like, I don't understand how it's every time. But
the general manager comes in and is like, well, as per tradition.
Very true. But yeah, I mean, I thought about this the other day. I walked in there and I was like, this is a pound less for this thing. I think it was yogurt or something like that. If I, you know, get the club card, well, how do I get the club card? Oh, you have to give them my data. And I was like, and I had the same reaction. I was like, I don't want you to have this, Tesco. I'll pay more for the, you know, which doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, it removes the sense of option and privacy, as to your point, why I think that is inherently bad.
It's an interesting question too, is like, are we moving more towards a world where like the people who are willing to give up their privacy and to some extent safety and security are actually like rewarded for that, you know, and then the rest of us are effectively penalized for it, you know, like
I do think that's what GDPR did. It made Tesco's and a bunch of other people have to come up with creative ways of going, how can we pay you for your data? Like before we'd pay someone else for your data, like Facebook. Now Facebook's getting blocked by the iOS app and all of that. Sorry, the iOS system.
Yes.
It's like, okay, well, how can we make a direct bargain with you? And yeah, it is through that kind of thing. Like, do you want to pay a quid less on this yogurt? Give us your data. But if you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be? And what problem would it solve? Would it be a loyalty card that does? Yeah.
No, it's not even to do with that. I think I spoke about this ages ago when I think 2018. I put in my BML 100. I think it was like called the Rising Star or nominated, that sort of thing. And it was to do with the ambulance service overstretched. So if we could find some sort of solution, that was like 2018, let alone what we're going through now. I think we really need to think of something. So if there's anyone who wants to collaborate, let's get me in the room. I'm happy to see what we could do around that. I think it's really bad. And the amount of technology we have, why aren't we doing better? I've heard stories where people, depending on where you live, I heard someone got an ambulance from Wales and they were in North London. Crazy stuff like that. 3-4 hour times where sometimes the operator will tell you you're better off getting a cab.
Wow.
Such a rough profession as well.
Yeah.
I used to know a couple of ambulance like first responders and it's just like fucking hell. Like you're underpaid, your hours are insane, you don't get like anything like the sort of like mental health support you should, given that you see someone die every day. Yeah. Like it, yeah, it's rough.
I can't imagine. I mean, the vicarious trauma that you get from that, you know, and seeing trauma, experiencing it yourself in a way, and kind of, yeah, you wonder if there's sort of, there's a tech solve for that almost. Like
driverless cars,
but also, yeah, like could a robot load someone into, and obviously you want the care and support of the human to some extent, right? But like that is a one area where it's like, okay, we don't want humans going through that kind of vicarious trauma and stuff like that. So, and could they do it faster, you know, and better? I don't know.
It's a tricky one, but I think we've got scope. I think that's where we should be looking to develop ways of just being more efficient. And I don't know what the solution is, but I'm keen to be in a room to discuss it.
Along those lines, we like to ask about predictions. So any predictions you have for the tech space, or maybe even the, you know, could be poetry space, creative industry for 2023, looking forward?
I mean, speaking about AI, it's definitely AI. I think it's going to be more in the medical sector. GP times are astronomical. Just even getting through to a GP is astronomical. Yeah. So I can imagine we're going to pivot quite quickly, probably the next 2 to 3 years, into a space where a lot of things are automated, because not even a receptionist can keep up with the amount of calls again.
So
they're that the gatekeeper between you and the doctor.
Yeah.
And if they're not actually taking a call which could save a life, then people effectively are dying. So I'm not saying that we're going to replace receptionists. I'm not saying that, because again, you need human intervention, because they could ask a question off script, because they're human, obviously, which could save a life as well, but just helping them with their workload.
Yeah.
And doctors as well, because they're, I've known a couple of GPs and they're very stressed.
I think we saw that in lockdown and the pandemic, where the health profession sort of, they made massive leaps, you know, like in the space of a year or two, and realizing that they could do so much preventative work, so much sort of just like, I don't know what you call this, but, you know, just like answering questions and queries and things like that, instead of the person having to make an appointment, take up the receptionist's time, take up the nurse's time, come in, talk to the doctor, get their question answered, you know. So like the front loading of work that can be done through digital tools, I think is fascinating. And I agree. I think they're going to take it even further and say, like, how can we actually solve problems?
Last question of the lightning round. This is one that I think your kind of career is a testament to. Like, what has worked well for you in terms of building a career that, like, obviously balances profit with purpose? All the works that you shared with us, like, have both in it. Like, like, what made you, what have been your success there?
I think because I've got attention, I love and hate technology. I'm being honest. So you can tell by I'm saying this is great, and then you hear me the next set is like, well, this is really bad.
Yep.
So I think that balance view has helped. So like, I see how technology can be very good, but I can see where we can overuse technology and use it as a crutch, which is not helping us as a society revolutionize and evolve if we get too reliant. In terms of sustainability, I try to, because I change my equipment relatively regularly, so like 3-year cycle, sometimes 5, depending on how much I invested initially. So, but I believe in not necessarily throwing away, but giving to someone that needs it. I think that's an ethical approach we need to take.
Definitely. Kieran, this has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's been
really
a pleasure.
Honestly, like, one of our best episodes yet. Poetry on the episode, I mean, this has been amazing.
No problem. It's been a lot of fun.
We'll be sure to share this far and wide with the poetry community, the tech community. They'll love it. So,
much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you. So this has been another episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast by Little Humans. We've been joined today by Kieran Rennie, the creative in residence at the English National Opera, the ENO, and creative consultant and performance poet. Thanks so much for your time today, man.
Thank you.
And if our viewers were wanting to check out some of your work, where can they find you on the internet?
Oh, brilliant. So it's kierenrennie.com. So it's www. as we know, kierenrennie.com. So have a look on Instagram when I'm on Instagram. That's my digital sketchbook, and I'm playing around with TikTok a bit as well. I'll try to do a bit more lifestyle thing when I can find the capacity, but yeah.
We'll be sure to share that in the episode description. And for our guests, please, so we can keep bringing on great folks like Kieran, like, share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating on all of your podcast platforms, and we'd greatly appreciate it. So
please do.
Thank you. All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.